Kierkegaard, who was an existentialist, once talked about a philosophy teacher who was so oblivious to life that he dreamt that he was teaching his class, and he woke up and discovered he was. So you wake up and discover that you're listening to a philosophy teacher on existentialism, you'll know what happened. What I propose to do this morning is to give you a definition, classification, and then some significant themes of existentialism. You might almost consider this an existential typological study or trying to trace at least three main strands of existentialism. So as you read literature and your professor's been kind enough to tell me what you've read already, just remember, number one, I'm coming from the philosophical perspective, and you can think of the literary outlets, and you're probably interested in more of those and familiar with more of those than I am, though I've read many of them. But I'm interested in what is existentialism, definitionally, what are a classification of existentialists, and then how we can trace some of the main existential themes in these different classifications and draw them together and say, how would a Christian relate to existentialism? Is it possibly a Christian existentialist? Are the two incompatible? How would he relate? First of all, then, definition. I take it that an existentialist, broadly speaking, is someone who stresses subjectivity over objectivity. Now, he is not someone who says there is no objectivity, or a more radical existentialist might say everything is subjectivity, but he recognizes there is such a thing as a spatio-temporal world objectivity, but that's not what really counts. That's not the important thing. The important thing is the subjective, the I rather than the me. I am not my nerve endings. The I transcends the me. Subjectivity over objectivity. Secondly, an existentialist is someone who stresses the concrete rather than the abstract. In one sense, it's a reaction to traditional abstract philosophy that says the concrete, become a spectator in the game, a participator in the game of life. Don't be a spectator sitting in the stands watching the game go on. Get down on the field and participate. An existentialist is someone who stresses the individual rather than the group. Sociological studies are fine, historical studies are fine, group studies have their place, but the individual is what we're concerned with. Zeroing in on man as an individual in the concrete subjective relationships that he possesses. That leads to a fourth distinction. He is someone who stresses freedom over determinism. To put it in Sartre's language, me is determined. That's bad grammar, but good existentialism. Me is determined. I am not determined. My objectivity is determined. My subjectivity is not determined. I am free, horribly free, condemned to my freedom. I think you read some of Nausea. Did you read any of No Exit? Okay. Condemned to freedom. The freedom over determinism. Freud is said to have believed that man is completely subconsciously determined. Sartre says man is completely consciously determined, almost the antithesis of Freud. Fifthly, an existentialist is someone who stresses the personal over the propositional. It's not propositional, creedal statements that you can make or mental assent to a set of propositions that's important. It's personal commitment. This would be particularly true in Kierkegaard. The personal transcends the propositional. That leads us to the final distinction, which is the key thought of existentialism and from which all existentialism takes its takeoff point, existence over essence. An existentialist is someone who says existence is prior to essence. Put in common everyday language, isness comes before whatness. In this sense of the word, some traditional thinkers like Thomas Aquinas even are said to be existential because of his stress on isness or esse, to use a Latin word, or to be-ness. It's to be-ness rather than what you are, who you are, and that you are is the important thing. Now, with that general definition of existentialism, let me trace three classifications, Roman numeral two. Theistic existentialists, those who believe in God. Atheistic existentialists, those who definitely don't believe in God. And what I'll call non-theistic existentialists, those who prefer to remain neutral on the question. Theistic existentialists, I want to mention two, there are many more, but the father of existentialism, not commonly known, oh, here's a bigger piece right here. The father of existentialism, of course, is Soren Kierkegaard. Soren Kierkegaard was the first existentialist, and he antedates many modern existentialists by quite a time period. Incidentally, I apologize if I don't have some of these dates or facts in mind because I had to change this lecture. I thought I was speaking on something else last night, so I don't have all the little details in mind. You'll have to forgive me. I do happen to remember these dates. All the other ones I don't remember. Soren Kierkegaard died in 1855. In 1855, Soren Kierkegaard was kind of a literary quack, he was considered in his own day. He was a nut, a hunchbacked oddball that everybody took as, you know, a guy that was having trouble with his fiance and girlfriend, Regina Olsen, and they couldn't figure him out. So he really is the fatherhead, but the atheistic stream of existentialism emanates, though Nietzsche was not technically an existentialist. He did, he died in 1900. I don't remember the date of Nietzsche's birth, but the date of a man's death is more important anyway because he's usually more influential closer to his death than he is his birth, which makes good sense. He's the father of atheistic existentialism, particularly when you get to Sartre. So what I'd like to consider is Nietzsche and Sartre as examples of atheistic existentialism, and Kierkegaard and Buber, Martin Buber, who is a Jewish existentialist, is an example of theistic. Martin Buber believes in God, Kierkegaard believes in God, Nietzsche doesn't believe in God, Sartre doesn't believe in God, so we got two live men on each side of the issue, but are both existentialism, which is really interesting. Existentialism must be a very broad movement, attitude, category if it can include people who believe in God and people who don't. Then in the middle group, non-theist, I just want to mention one person, and that's Heidegger, H-E-I-D, Heidegger. Martin Heidegger prefers to be neutral on the question, and he just wants to study being. Now, if you were asking to give one sentence that kind of sums up these three movements, I would say something like this. A theistic existentialist is someone who has had an encounter with God. We'll use the word encounter because it's a good existential word and it describes what's going on. So Buber and Kierkegaard are saying the important thing in life, the existential thing, the subjective thing, is to have an encounter with God. Atheistic existentialists like Nietzsche and Sartre are saying have an encounter with nothingness. The title of Sartre's major philosophical work is Being and Nothingness. Nausea. Ugh. That's what I think of life. Man is an empty bubble on the sea of nothingness, Sartre said. So it's an encounter with nothing. And Nietzsche also had the same feeling. God is dead, and all values died with him, and I find myself encountering nothingness. Nihilism is a more pessimistic thing that springs from this kind of attitude that Nietzsche expressed. So an encounter with God, an encounter with nothingness. Whereas Heidegger, the third category, is saying, let's have an encounter with being. He kind of flips the coin over and says, well, let's study Dasein, the thrust one, man. Let's study the man there, Dasein. And the title of his book is Being and Time, because man is the temporal, thrust, contingent, being toward death one. or in terms of these categories, Kierkegaard had an encounter with God. Nietzsche had an encounter with the death of God. And Heidegger has an encounter with man, Dasein, studies being, Sein through Dasein, being there. With that classification, let's go on now to Roman numeral 3, some significant themes that run through these existentialists. And what I'm doing is picking themes, weaving them together, so that when we get to the end, I can show you how all of those themes could fit into a Christian attitude toward existentialism, including all of the insights of the non-Christians and non-theists as well. Let's take Nietzsche, two themes from Nietzsche. God is dead, and the will of eternal recurrence. Nietzsche is one of a number of atheists. There are classification of atheists might go something like this. A traditional atheist who believes that God never was alive. He's always been dead. God has always been dead. A dialectical atheist. A traditional example of traditional atheist would be Sartre. Dialectical atheist would be Altheiser. What ever happened to Altheiser? You used to hear a lot of him 10, 15 years ago when the death of God movement was strong. I suppose he's still kicking around somewhere. Altheiser said God died dialectically. The thesis, theism. The antithesis, atheism. God died in the incarnation. When God became man, he died, emptied heaven. And of course, Christ died on the cross and didn't rise from the dead, according to Altheiser. Therefore, God is dead. And we've just discovered this in the last 200 years. So God died dialectically. He really was alive, and he really died. Then you have what might be called the semantical or linguistic atheist. Semantical atheists would be people like A.J. Ayer, the logical positivist, and the early Van Buren, Paul Van Buren's book, The Secular Meaning of the Gospel, where he said, the word God died. It's no more meaningful to talk about God. God talk is dead. Then you have Nietzsche, who is a different category, and Nietzsche, I take it, is a mythological atheist. Mythological atheist, meaning that Nietzsche believes that there was once a live myth. A myth is a model by which men live. And this model by which men live was once a viable one. It was a fruitful one. It was an effective one in society. People really believed it, and it really transformed their lives in society. And then that model died. That model is no longer useful. And I take it that what Nietzsche is saying is the myth God died. But don't take myth in the weakest sense of the word. Take myth in a live, strong, macro model with which molds a man's life sense. So if this is what Nietzsche is saying, Nietzsche is a very profound man because he was very perceptive, and he looked at society and he said, when I look at Europe, I see nothingness. I see a form with no faith inside of it. I see the ritual with no reality. I see that the church is God's tombstone and the preachers are his pallbearers. And I hear the recessional of Christianity being played in the background, as it were. And we ought to pronounce God dead and rejoice in the fact and move on to something else. Second insight that Nietzsche had, oh, incidentally, when he said God died, he also recognized that all value died with him. Nietzsche was a logical man in one sense, that his mind saw the consequences. If there is no absolute beyond the world, then there are no absolute obligations in the world, then anything goes. And he said, when people discover this, a universal madness is going to break out in the world. Wars are going to break out. Now notice he died in 1900, followed by the First World War, Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam War. Very prophetic, profound man. His second theme is, if this is true and there is no God and there are no absolute values, what can man do? He said, will the eternal recurrence of the same state of affairs. Recognize that Christian view of history as linear is wrong. History is not going somewhere. There is no God beyond it, and there is no God on the other end. There is no alpha and omega, like Chardin would say, the omega point of history. God is dead, and all we can do is will the eternal internal recurrence of the same state of affairs, kind of a cyclical view of human experience and history. Now, in Camus, the myth of Sisyphus, which I hope you get a chance to look at a little bit sometime, if not in this course, Camus dramatizes this from that ancient Greek myth, you know, roll the rock up the hill to let it roll down, to roll it up the hill, condemned to the meaninglessness of the same state of affairs forever. No God, meaninglessness. Now let's pick up on Sartre, take two themes from Sartre. Man is a useless passion, nausea almost everywhere, and freedom is inescapable, no exit. Sartre looked at this whole post-Nietzschean world, and he too had profound sensitivities toward it. He said, I see nausea. I see existential vomit. Life is meaningless. Someone has characterized it this way. Life is an aimless journey that begins with an erratic sexual act and ends in a final nothingness. And when I look at the fact that there is no God, and there never has been one for him, because, and Sartre gives this argument, God must be a self-caused being, because no one else caused him, but to be self-caused is impossible. You can't cause your own existence, therefore it's impossible for there to be a God. And Sartre said in his autobiography entitled Words, which is fascinating reading, when I was a little kid, he said, I was burning a hole in a rug and God convicted me of my sin. And I said, anyone so ungentlemanly as to intrude into a child's machinations isn't worthy to be believed in. So I gave up believing in God. He said, I had a problem though. He said, I could get rid of God the Father, but the Holy Spirit latched himself in the back of my neck. He said, one day I caught the Holy Spirit in the cellar and I threw him out, and he's never bothered me since. So Sartre reacted not only logically, but he reacted psychologically against God. If there is a God, he's invading my freedom. I am free, therefore there is no God. Now, this kind of thing, Sartre said, shows the futility of life. There is no objective meaning. Meaning is all subjective. You create your own meaning. Meaning is not discovered out there. When they went to give Sartre the Nobel Prize for Literature, what did he say? I'm a phony. Everything I ever wrote was is phony, so he refused the Nobel Prize. He was being consistent. Empty. Freedom is inescapable, Sartre. In his book, No Exit, it's a story of three people in hell. And during the play, in the middle of hell, the door opens up and they're given the opportunity to leave and no one leaves. Sartre says, see, the door of hell is locked on the inside. You're condemned to your own freedom. Hell is what you choose. Hell is other people. There's a mirror on the wall and Inez looked in the mirror and see yourself. Hell is thinking of yourself in terms of the reflection you get off others and condemned to your own choices. Heidegger, two themes. Being unto death, and his famous question, why is there something rather than nothing at all? Heidegger analyzed man, Dasein, man in time. He says, man is a being unto death. It's like being born on a track, going downward toward a cliff. You didn't choose to be on the train, you didn't choose to be on the track, and you didn't choose for their cliff to be there, but that's it. You see some of the condemned to freedom on the track to death, over the cliff, a being unto nothingness, a being unto death. This is what causes angst, the German word for objectless fear. Fear is fear of this, of the cat, of high places, but angst is an objectless fear, fear of nothingness. Because you're a being unto nothingness and you have a fear of nothingness, you're contingent. And because you're contingent, and because all of life is contingent, ungrounded, as it were, Heidegger said, second point, the most important question that a man can ask is this, why is there something rather than nothing at all? Why is there something rather than nothing at all? Now, I'd like to move one other person who is an existentialist in at this point, Paul Tillich. because Paul Tillich picked up on Heidegger, and here's what he said. Tillich would be roughly a theistic existentialist. He said, I'll answer Heidegger's question. Why is there something rather than nothing at all? Because there's a ground of being. Because all being that is ungrounded, and I'm an ungrounded being, must be grounded in something. And Paul Tillich said there must be a God who is the ground of my contingency, because you can't be thrust unless something thrusts you. Being can't be given unless there's a giver. It can't be contingent unless there's a necessary ground for its contingency. And then Tillich said, that means that you and I, second theme in Tillich, have an ultimate commitment. And our ultimate commitment should be to the ultimate. A lot of people have an ultimate commitment to a car, to a country called patriotry, my country, right or wrong, to a person. Our ultimate commitment, said Tillich, ought to be to the ultimate, which is the ground of our very being. Two themes from Tillich: ground of being, ultimate commitment. Now let's take Buber. Two themes. One book entitled The Eclipse of God, another book titled I, Thou. Buber said, you know what the problem with philosophy is and the reason that God has been obscured from people? What obscures God is human conceptual systems, human philosophies. Men build up a philosophy, and then they look through their philosophy, and they can't see God. And their philosophy is a colored set of glasses. Let's say God were green, and they build a pink set of glasses, and they look through, and they say, I don't see anything green. Philosophical systems, eclipsing or cutting out God from their life. What we really need, second theme, is an I-thou relationship. An I-thou relationship is a relation of person to person rather than person to thing. It's a relationship that says, I want to treat you as an end in yourself, not as a means. Someone said the travesty of ethics in the 20th century is that we have loved things and used people rather than using things and loving people. And Buber would agree with that. Let's relate to people as an I, a thou, a person, rather than as a thing. Therefore, if we take these philosophical systems, conceptual systems, rip them out of the way, and confront ourselves face to face with God. Let me mention something from someone who's not an existentialist, but who has a very excellent book on this point. C.S. Lewis wrote a book entitled Till We Have Faces. And in this book, he said the problem with people who say, I don't see God, I don't hear God, is not that God is dead, it's that we're deaf. And what we've done is we've built up masks, and God will never show his face to someone unless we show our face to him, rip off the mask, and say, here I am, just as I am, and then we'll have a face-to-face experience with God. Buber would agree with that 100%. I-thou relationship, rip off the fences we build around ourselves. Then Soren Kierkegaard, two themes. Kierkegaard said that there comes a time in your life that you must realize that the ethical and the aesthetic are not high enough, that a man's ultimate responsibility goes beyond aesthetics, it goes beyond ethics, and it goes into the religious. He built three stages of life. The aesthetic stage is the level, it is the kind of man-centered stage in life. Everything is egocentric around me, my feelings, what I like. The ethical stage is the law-centered stage. And he said, you must choose, either or. You must choose to choose. Get out of this man-centered and realize that there is not just a obligation to the now, there's an obligation to all of life, and the obligation to all of life transcends the obligation to this moment. But that's not high enough yet. Despair will lead you to the point where you must make a leap of faith and realize that the ethical stage, keeping laws, doing good, is not sufficient, but you must transcend the ethical in an encounter with a God who has revealed himself to you through Jesus Christ. And this God who has revealed himself through Christ says, I want an I-thou, person-to-person relationship with you. And this is a relationship for eternity. gives a beautiful illustration of a boat and a sailor watching the monotony of the sea, wave after wave lapping on the ship. Bored with the monotony, who says, the only way to overcome that is to look at a fixed star beyond that isn't moving. And the monotonies and rotations and absurdities of life are overcome by eternity, by fixing your mind on something beyond this world that can transform your life in this world. Kierkegaard, in his Religious Over the Ethical. This means, says Kierkegaard, that just mental assent to a creed isn't enough. Just saying, I believe the Bible, is not sufficient. You've got to have a personal relationship, a person-to-person encounter. Now, if I may summarize briefly, I would like to suggest that all of these themes that I have woven together all speak something very important from a Christian point of view. That Nietzsche and Sartre are right in saying that man is dead and meaningless apart from God. All of life is an empty bubble on the sea of nothingness if there is no God. That anything goes if there is no God. That you have no value, no dignity if there is no God who said, you're in my image and you must be treated with ultimate respect. I think Heidegger asked the right question. Why is there something rather than nothing at all? And I think Tillich gave the right answer. Because there's a ground of being that grounds our contingency. I think Buber was right in saying that philosophy cuts a man out from God. I've seen it time and time again. A man who will deny God in the top of his head can't deny him in the bottom of his heart. There is something that man wants to build a fence from the intrusions of the divine. Sartre's illustration, anyone who convict me of burning matches isn't worthy to be believed. And I caught him in the cellar and I threw him out. Nietzsche once said, if you could prove God to me, I'd believe him all the less. Kind of an emotive reaction. I think that Buber is right in saying that philosophy cuts out God, and he's right in saying we need an interpersonal I-thou experience. We're so seeming, we're so phony. We never really relate to each other as persons, and we don't do that because we don't realize at all interpersonal relationships are grounded in personhood. That all I-thou relationships are grounded in the capital I. That unless there is a person who can ground interpersonal relationships, they're not possible. I think Kierkegaard is right in saying that you'll never become ultimately related to the ultimate by being immediately related to the immediate. Only by a personal encounter with the God from beyond who has revealed himself through Jesus Christ and an existential commitment, not for time and not for this moment, but for eternity. Okay, let me stop there and suggest that that's a basic definition, classification, and some central themes of existentialism that are perfectly compatible. Is not only perfectly compatible, but what I said at the end is my own personal conviction and view as to what a Christian existentialism would be, and just give you a chance to ask any questions that you may have. Don't ask them too deep because I didn't have a chance to look up all the little interesting things I would like to have looked up if I were preparing this lecture. It's only a half hour. I had to do that last night. Okay, any comments or questions or reactions? You can ask anything you want, but I can just tell you I don't know.
On a Tillich's ground of being,
yeah.
How would he say that when the ground of being have to have a ground of being too?
No, because, see, Sartre's problem, it's like Bertrand Russell's question, who made God? The principle of causality says every finite, limited, contingent thing needs a cause. But when you get a necessary, infinite thing, it doesn't need a cause. So you don't need a ground for the ground, because the ground is the ground. If you ask, what grounded the ground, you're asking a meaningless question, because that's like saying, what caused the first cause? If it is the first cause, there's no cause of it because it's first.
What kind of a definition would you give of ground?
Well, this is quite a phenomenological term, as you know. You can define it in different ways. I would say
cause would be one way to define it. That's the traditional classic way. Say, for example, someone in the Thomistic tradition would use the word cause. Necessary and sufficient condition would be the way a modern logician would want to describe it. Ground means that there is something, if I am thrust, there must be something thrust in me. If I am given, there must be something giving me. Nietzsche makes a very revealing statement once when he said, I receive, but I do not ask where it came from. Of course, if you receive, but don't bother asking where it came from, you'll never get to the giver of the gift of life. There are different metaphors that can be used, and they're evocative in different ways.
Would this derivative in some way ultimately from Aquinas' third proof?
I think so. I think you can show a historic connection between Aquinas' third way there and the influence through Tillich. Difference between carrying your logic through and saying it must finish here in something that is meaningful and ultimate to which I respond, and failing to carry the logic through and just leaving an eternal question mark there because I don't want to respond to the ultimate conclusion.
So this is one of the reasons the point of the word you use, the unknown fear, it stops there, and the other is beyond that,
using the other end, more
faith or whatever word you want.
I'd rather think of that as a beginning point, but you're right on the other point too. The other night I used this illustration I got from Richard Kaler. Some of you in the room have heard it, but Richard Kaler said if you had a theist and an atheist walking through the woods and they came on a translucent ball, 8 foot in diameter,
they would both agree that something had to cause it. Something had to ground it. It didn't come there out of nowhere. Something doesn't come out of nothing.
Then if the theist said to the atheist, what if that ball is 16 foot in diameter? Does it still need a cause to ground? The atheist would say yes. The theist says to the atheist, what if the ball is 8,000 miles in diameter and 25,000 miles around? The atheist still agrees it has to have a cause, because little balls need causes, and medium-sized ones, and big ones do too. Now, here's the difference between the theist and the atheist. When the theist says, what if that ball is as big as the whole universe? Does it still need a cause? The atheist says, no, it doesn't need a cause. Little balls need causes, medium-sized ones do, but the biggest ball of all doesn't need a cause. Now, why does he say that? He's stating the ultimate and inevitable conclusion.
What about there's a theory in the universe that caused itself and turns back into itself?
I think
wouldn't that bypass the
I think
first cause question?
It would. And really, the atheists have been the people who have given the strongest arguments against that. Sartre, remember, said, if you conceive of God as a self-caused being, this is the grounds on which he was an atheist. He said, God must be a self-caused being. He didn't understand that God was an uncaused being. He forgot the other alternative. God must be self-caused. He said, self-caused is impossible. The cause is prior to the effect. To cause yourself, you'd have to be prior to yourself. To cause yourself, you'd have to exist in order to cause. You'd have to not exist in order to need to be caused. You'd have to exist and not exist at the same time. Sartre says, nonsense. And I say, right, Sartre, nonsense. Self-caused being. Uncaused being, good sense. Self-caused being, good sense.
I got a question. You're saying that God had to have a cause, or he had to exist or whatever the
necessary
reason, not necessary. Why couldn't the world exist without God? Why couldn't it just have been there?
For the very reason this last parable I gave, making the ball bigger doesn't eliminate the need for a cause.
Well, true, but I seems to be that I can equate God with the ball.
Oh, well, then you're saying God is finite, or you're either saying the world is infinite. If you say the world is infinite, necessary, and eternal, that's what's meant by God. If you say the world is finite, then it's contingent and it needs a cause. So you take one or the other alternative. See, where the scientist sneaks this in on us is the first law of thermodynamics. The second law says the amount of available energy is decreasing. Everything that is subject to change or limitation needs a cause. The first law says energy can neither be created nor destroyed. And I say, where did you get that? Not from science. That's not a scientific premise. That's a philosophical presupposition. Energy is uncreated, eternal power. That's what I mean by God. An eternal, uncreated power. First law of thermodynamics is just a covert definition for God. But anything that is changing, finite, or limited needs a cause. When you get to an unchanging infinite, it doesn't need a cause. It is the cause, just like the first law says.
It's like the universe
goes
through its existence. It itself without God being.
Well, that's like saying an effect can exist without a cause. That's like saying a being there can be given without a giver, or can be thrust without a thruster. If it is contingent, and this is where Heidegger and Sartre are very helpful in understanding this, man is a being unto death, he's contingent. And if by universe you mean infinite, eternal, necessary being, which is the ground of it, then of course that's what the theist means by God. If by universe you mean finite, limited, contingent being, then it needs a cause. You want to carry the logic through, it does. Now you don't have to carry the logic through. That's the interesting thing about the existential emphasis. God never forces himself on anyone. It may be convincing to the mind, but the will can always say, as Ivan in Dostoevsky's novel said, in essence, in one place, and you have to forgive me because I don't have the reference. I would have brought it and read it to you if I'd known I was going to quote it here. He said, in essence, if there were a God, I wouldn't believe him. Anyone who would treat people like that, I would. Well, that is an existential reaction of freedom that every man can have. Nietzsche said, if you could prove him, I'd believe him all the less. So there's always the ability, all of this evidence that I've suggested always at best indicates that there is a God, whether man's going to believe in him or not. There's
up to his own free will. And he's condemned to his own freedom. Remember Sartre said, no exit? The Bible says God is love. Now what if I said to my girlfriend, I love you, I want you to marry me. She says, well, I like you, but I don't want to marry you. And I say, well, I love you so much, I'll make a good husband. Please marry me. She says, well, sorry, I don't want you. And I said, I love you so much, I'm going to force you to love me. Force love is not love. It's great. And God is not a divine race. So because God is love, he'll never force himself on anyone. He'll always give them their free will to respond or to reject. That's why they're in hell. And that's why the door is locked on the inside. Read C.S. Lewis' book, The Great Divorce, where he says there are only two kinds of people in the world. One says, thy will be done, O God. And the other one says, God says, because thy will be done. The door of hell is locked on the inside. The only way it could be is there's a loving God.
Could you work this the other way? Excuse me, just
sure. Do
you want? It's linked right to that. If you were to turn this around, you could say the same thing with people like, I think, I'm asking partly, but with people like Kierkegaard on the one hand, I think, and certainly Unamuno on the other hand, who will essentially refuse the kind, at least as I understand them, the kind of logical arguments you were just doing. And instead of refusing them and saying, I will not believe, refuse them and say, because they're refusing, I do believe.
Yes, I do see what
you're saying.
And I think there are hints, but no real development in them. This last distinction I was making, there's a difference between belief in and belief that. And I think because they're existentialists, they're stressing the belief in, and that's free, and there's no intellectual coercion on belief in. I think reason has to do with belief that. And will has to do with belief in. And what they're saying is absolutely right. You can't force a man to believe in something, because then it wouldn't be a matter of belief. It wouldn't be a matter of his freedom. But there are good reasons to believe that. For example, when I go home, and I go in the driveway and into the arms of the waiting wife and give her a kiss and discover I just kissed a neighbor lady, you'd say, hey, something's wrong, Geisler. How come you made that existential commitment without looking at the evidence that it was the wrong house and the wrong woman before you embraced it? So what we're trying to say is belief that is important, prerequisite to belief in, and that a man doesn't want to commit intellectual suicide. What if to become a Christian, I had to believe in square circles and commit intellectual suicide? I'd never be a Christian. I got to have some reason that it's true before I'm going to make my existential commitment. If I didn't believe that there was a woman at the altar, that she would make a good wife, I'd never say I do. But just because she will make a good wife doesn't mean I have to say I do. I choose not to. Choose not to marry. Same thing with God.
So essentially, just the function of reason to clear away some of the debris, and then at that point you make the choice.
That's right.
And that would be the same with the choice of philosophy, the choice of politics, ideology.
That's right. Man ought to. Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. And I think the unexamined state is not worth believing. I would give a hoot for something for which there was no historical, rational evidence. But the great thing about Christianity is it's not a quiver in the liver, a blessing in the bosom type thing. There's a historical, verifiable Christ and Bible. There's a reasonable God who exists, and you don't have to commit intellectual suicide to be a Christian. I would never be.
Yeah, what about other religions?
What proof are you referring to?
The apostle.
Proof that he was God. Well, Muhammad never claimed to be God, and he never rose from the dead. Christ claimed to be God, rose from the dead. I'd say that's quite different.
There are other disciples.
Right, but no other history has resurrection. That's the difference. Peter said, we have not shown us you cunningly devised myth of the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Well,
let me suggest a book to you. Frank Morrison was a skeptic who said Christianity isn't historical, the resurrection isn't true, and he looked into historically to disprove it. And he wrote a book, it's subtitled, The Book That Refused to Be Written. And the title of it is, Who Moved the Stone? And in the process of looking at the evidence, he said the evidence
favor of the historicity of Christianity and the resurrection was so great that he committed himself to Christ and became a Christian. This same thing that Frank Morrison, who moved the stone, happened to Lord Littleton, to William Ramsey, and a teacher of law at Harvard named Simon Greenleaf, who wrote the book on legal evidence. His students challenged him to apply legal evidence to Christianity, and he did, and he became a Christian and wrote a book entitled The Testimony of the Evangel, proving that Christ rose from the dead and Christianity true. So it's at least objectively verifiable. Intelligent people have looked into it, have looked at the evidence, and have become Christian. I'd recommend that, you know, if you're an intelligent, open-minded person who wants to look at all sides of it, take a look at Morrison's book, Who Moved the Stone. How's our time? Just about up. We got time for one or two more quick questions.
I was going to ask you what is hell, brought up hell a while ago.
Okay, I think a meaningful Christian concept of hell from an existential point of view, to kind of get into your class, is Sartre had the best insight into it. Hell is where a man is condemned to the ultimacy of his own choice to accept or reject God. Hell is loneliness that comes from wanting to be alone in the universe, not wanting to relate to anyone else. Hell is separation from God. Hell is saying, I have chosen this way, and I'm not going to submit to anyone beyond me. I'm going to keep my own choice. Hell is doing your own thing. Have you ever been in a room with five spoiled brats, all doing your own thing? How would you like to be in a room with 2 million people all doing your own thing? That's hell. Heaven is harmony. Everyone's doing the same thing, like an orchestra, a choir. Thy will be done is heaven. Thy will be done. Oh, definitely. I think a lot of people right now that have started their hell because they're separated from meaning and from God and from truth, and they're just getting a head start on hell.
What? How do you know that happens after life? I see it does happen in life.
Well, we know because God revealed himself in history, proved that he has credibility of saying that he is God through Jesus Christ, and Christ taught that there was. That's just a brief answer in 2 seconds.